You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Members Only by Nate Freeman. First, a photo, Super Friends. Zero Bond's status as Mayor Eric Adams' de facto backroom added to its public profile early on, helping to attract the likes of Kim Kardashian. And 2023 Met Gala after-partiers, such as Aubrey Plaza, Jared Leto, and Baz Luhrmann, and Gigi Hadid, a NoHo neighbor with Tan France. Sartiano is the first to admit that he has slim experience in the museum world, and an investigation by local website Hellgate revealed that some of the paperwork related to his appointment contained basic errors. There was a miscommunication on the draft of the cover letter, but I stand by the content in the letter and application, Sartiano later said by email. The outlet also pointed out that Sartiano, who bought a $3.5 million loft a block away from Zero Bond in 2022, is one of the many NoHo dwellers to benefit from Adams' vetoing of a zoning bill that would have required non-artist buyers in the neighborhood to pay hefty fees. Adams was heavily lobbied by a wide coalition of city polls and even some artists to scrap the bill. Adams' office has said the mayor and Sartiano never discussed the rezoning plan. Sartiano is proud to sit on the Met's board. He has nothing but kind words about a mayor who has been much maligned elsewhere of late and thought fondly back to election night as a special moment for Zero Bond. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think it was a statement to have something there, he said. The juxtaposition, the counterpoint to Bill de Blasio, who would have rather poured gasoline on a members' club and lit a match than supported it. I'm willing to bet that during COVID, Zero Bond was the largest hospitality hirer in New York City. We hired 80 people when you can only have 50 people inside. And I think the mayor saw that and respected it, and past administrations wouldn't have cared. In the last few months, the headlines around the Adams administration, once reliably light comic stuff befitting a truth-stretching, club-going mayor, have grown cloudier. The FBI is investigating whether the Adams campaign illegally colluded with the Turkish government and has raided the homes of multiple aides and seized at least two of Adams' phones. In March, the mayor was sued for sexual assault by a former NYPD staffer who accused him of forcing himself on her in 1993 after telling her he would help her career. He denied the allegations. When we spoke earlier this year, Sartiano said that Adams, who is not a member, is never partying when he's out, and added that he doesn't come by Zero Bond as much as he used to. On Wednesday night in January, while reporting this story, I did happen to catch Adams at the club, emerging from a back room. Sartiano excused himself to greet the mayor, and the pair worked the crowd together, chatting up investor Hannah Bronfman and Kardashian universe personality Jonathan Chaban before taking the long way to the exit, conversing as they walked. Sartiano was born in Pittsburgh and spent much of his childhood in South Carolina before going to a tennis academy near Greenville, North Carolina, and heading to New York to play at Columbia. I didn't have money to go to a nightclub. I didn't know what a nightclub was, he said. I was in a nightclub twice in college, for less than an hour, probably, where people randomly brought me. And I was mesmerized by it. I was like, dude, this is God, you're in a movie. One summer, he took a job as a tennis coach in the Hamptons, and one of his clients was Mark Packer, who years before had opened the Italian spot Castells on a then-desolate Park Avenue South. Preempting the dining explosion that would take over the blocks clustered close to Union Square in the next decades, led by Danny Meyer joints. Soon enough, Sartiano was in touch with Jason Strauss and Noah Tepperberg, who would later become partners with Rich Wolf in Dow Group. He was stringing rackets on Main Street of Westhampton Beach, and Noah and I were throwing events at Conscience Point nightclub, Strauss said. We essentially asked him to help us sell tickets out of the pro shop. When Sartiano returned to the city, his tennis career on hold because of a wrist injury, he started promoting full-time. While not entirely his thing, it could be fairly lucrative, especially after he met a tenacious club kid named Richie Akiva. The two of them would follow owner-designer Steve Lewis to Spa, a sprawling club on 13th Street and Broadway that featured waterfalls, ample vegetation, and on one night, a room affixed with cameras called the Freak Box. At the end of the day, nightlife's about fun. Once you get through the door, it's just supposed to be really fun, Sartiano said of the Spa days. It was a giant party. Mark and Leo would always be there, he added, meaning Wahlberg and DiCaprio. I think Pharrell and Timberlake met at my table. He took what he learned at Spa, Life, and the secret boite he opened on Spring Street that people just called Scott's Place, and teamed up with Akiva to open Butter in 2002. We used to call a really hot girl, oh, she's Butter. Oh, if we saw that car, it'd be like, oh, that car is so Butter, Akiva recently recalled. The two were almost outlandishly ambitious for their age and experience level. As Akiva told the Times when it opened, I'm getting older and my people are too. We don't want another noisy lounge. We want a mellow, elegant place to dine. He was 25. Still, Butter didn't exactly follow all the rules of fine dining. New York called the menu and decor, which was anchored by a forest mural, Sylvan Chic. The Times noted that its hosts were more bouncers than maitre d's. The downstairs dining room had a DJ booth. We only had 8-9 tables downstairs, Akiva said. We used to have to make Janet Jackson and Prince share a table, Mariah and Jay-Z. I know for a fact no restaurant carried Red Bull before we did, Sartiano said. In the era of Paris and Lindsay, it worked. There were lines of Maybach and black SUVs waiting outside of Butter, Huck said. There were paparazzi just swarming the place every Monday. It was like a line up and down the street. You could not get in. It helped that Sartiano had become a minor tabloid figure, dating Anne Hathaway, Ashley Olsen, and Jamie Lynn Siegler. Sartiano and Akiva eventually got in on the club scene that had taken over West Chelsea by launching One Oak, a slightly smaller and more elite version of the mega clubs that had preceded it. It was another hit. When the Yankees won the World Series in 2009, A-Rod, Derek Jeter, and CeCe Sabathia led the party to One Oak. After Jay-Z opened Barclays Center in 2012, he celebrated at One Oak. Rihanna hosted her Met Gala after party at One Oak in 2017, a few hours after shutting down the red carpet. According to Page Six, by the time One Oak had expanded to Vegas, L.A., and Mexico City, it was pulling in $50 million annually, making the same premium off charging tenfold for slinging wholesale bottles of liquor to rich kids. It later opened locations in the Maldives and Tokyo. But Sartiano wanted out. He was ready to settle down with his fiancée, Ali Rizzo, and pivot to something else. Better restaurants, maybe, or even a hotel. He agreed to a buyout. The price he and Akiva, who had been working together since their early 20s, agreed upon was first negotiated in 2015 and would include revenue from their One Oak offshoots in Tokyo and Dubai. I said, please, Scott, don't do it. There's a light at the end of the tunnel, Akiva said. I said, if you're going to sell it, I would appreciate it if you don't sell it to someone on the market. I have to take a partner that I'm not familiar with. I'd rather you sell it to me. By 2017, Sartiano said he hadn't been paid any royalties. Akiva, Sartiano says, was reporting to investors that the clubs were struggling and he was bleeding money bad. He couldn't pay him any revenue. Finally, in July 2017, a settlement was drawn up. What Sartiano didn't know, he said in court papers, is that Akiva had quietly taken on a new partner, Daryl Katz, a reclusive Canadian billionaire who had years earlier bought the Edmonton Oilers. Sartiano said Katz had secretly bought a significant amount of the business from Akiva for $14.5 million. Akiva, Sartiano alleged, wasn't bleeding money. He was extremely well paid. And according to the timeline laid out by Sartiano, he was in violation of his contract. So Sartiano sued his former business partner for $15 million in 2018. 6 years later, the suit still drags on, with a judge denying Akiva's lawyer's request for dismissal. Discovery has dredged up a remarkable trove of private material from two otherwise very discreet men. Potential deals, events for Adams in the Hamptons, a billionaire feeling out Sartiano on his interest in a zero-bond outpost in Toronto. Not really, not yet anyway, Sartiano said. One nightlife source told me the split, and to some extent the protracted litigation, was all inevitable, a manifestation of the rupture between Akiva's and Sartiano's essential selves, the comp-doling promoter and the expense-minded business guy. I'm a little bit more eccentric and extravagant, and I want to spend this money, and I want to go crazy, and I want to be out there, and I'm hustling and bustling, Akiva later confirmed. Scott is more like the reality. I asked Sartiano about his former business partner on a Thursday morning in February, a few weeks after the trip to Vegas. The sun streamed in the fourth floor windows at Zero Bond, and there was a clear line of sight down Broadway into downtown. He tries not to think much about the lawsuit, he said. We definitely have our issues and differences, but in general, maybe it's a strength, maybe it's a weakness. I always wish people the best, he said. To wit, my nightlife source said he had personally seen Akiva at Zero Bond. I think they've managed to also stay professional in a really tough situation, the source said. So at least they've maintained a somewhat civil situation, which could have been a lot uglier. I'm happy for Scott, and I think he's done a great job with Zero Bond, Akiva said. I've always supported and wished him well in whatever he wants to do. I'm glad he's doing well. One night in 2017, Sartiano was talking with Brandon Charnas, a real estate broker who is married to Ariel Charnas, the founder of the then-thriving, now-notorious blog-turned-brand Something Navy. The entire dinner he kept saying, "You know, Zero Bond is available," Sartiano recalled. And I said, "I saw it, but it doesn't work for me." And he's like, "You know what? I'm not leaving dinner until you tell me you're going to walk it with me and think about it." And we walked like 2 days later, and he was right, and the rest was history. The space was too small for a hotel, so Sartiano seized on a concept that would marry his previous experiences, something between a nightclub and a hotel and a restaurant. He and co-founder Will Macris cast their ambitions against Soho House, which has nearly 200,000 members globally, and recently faced criticism from some that it's grown its roles too much. "I'm friends with the guys who own it, and I can't even get a table," Macris said of its meatpacking district location. and his peers in the hospitality industry had reasons to suspect that the concept would never get off the ground, given Sartiano's time out of the game. In our business, I think if you sit out for a little bit, you kind of lose it, and you've missed it. Once you take a little bit of time to recalculate or evaluate or whatever, the business changes so fast and moves so quick, said David Grutman, the Miami nightlife poobah who oversees a nightclub and restaurants at the Fontainebleau in Las Vegas. I actually was kind of cautious to see if Scott was going to be able to come back from taking some time off and evaluating his situation after One Oak. So when he said he was doing this members club and it took him a little bit to get it built and done and all that, I was really suspect to see if it was going to work or not. The space opened to members in October 2020, only to be shut down when indoor dining ended again and was allowed to reopen in February 2021 when restrictions were lifted with an event attended by Chaban and Adam Weitzman, the upstate scrap metal billionaire. Slowly the celebrities came. In April 2021, Bella Hadid walked over to Zero Bond, a few doors down from her sister Gigi's house, conveniently located at the terracotta-paneled corner condo building, Tin Bond. By the end of May, Hailey Bieber had come by. That July, Seth Meyers filmed one of his day-drinking segments with Lord there. Then there was the Adams campaign. The future mayor hung out with James Harden and Lala Anthony one night, Strauss and Tepperberg until 1:30 a.m. the next, and Charlie and Dixie D'Amelio the next. And each time, he was brought to the club by member Ron Tarosian, the controversial PR maven who's repped the Eric Trump Foundation and Girls Gone Wild founder Joe Francis. Tarosian's close with Sartiano, too. I've known him more than 20 years, and in many ways, he's one of these quiet geniuses you never see coming, Tarosian told me. Zero Bond has quite the legit collection of art on the walls. Andy Warhol and Keith Haring were easy choices, given the NoHo connection. The Andy Warhol Foundation is a block away, and the Keith Haring Foundation is housed in his former studio on the fifth floor of 676 Broadway, the building directly next to Zero Bond. But Sartiano went a step further and asked Gagosian sales and artist liaison Sophia Cohen, daughter of Mets owner and hedge fund billionaire Steve Cohen, to curate a pretty serious contemporary art program. Cohen said that Sartiano reminds her of giant titans of industry in terms of his skill for delegation. The reason why Zero Bond's so successful is that Scott really wanted to mold a lot of worlds together, she said. The work with Cohen was one of the qualifications Sartiano cited when Adams' staff asked for a CV in advance of naming him the mayor's representative to the board of the Metropolitan Museum. Sartiano was soon invited to swank dinners with his fellow trustees, including one for the mayor attended by Alejandro Santo Domingo, financier Blair Efron, collectors Katie Marin and Merrill Tisch, and billionaire Met donor Oscar Tang. Sartiano is self-aware enough to know that he's not like the other board members, and he doesn't seem worried. My training was a little different, he said. I was more in the cultural institution of food and beverage, which is part of culture in New York City. Sartiano has made it clear that he'll back Adams for re-election next year. But what happens if a mayor with a 28% approval rating can't win again? Challengers are lining up. Former comptroller and mayoral candidate Scott Stringer said he might face off against Adams. Ousted Governor Andrew Cuomo has flirted with a run as well. While finishing up the Dover Sole at his Mercer Hotel restaurant, I thought back to one of Sartiano's first press clippings in a career of getting ink, a story in Columbia College Today from January 2004 that has this as a lead. Scott Sartiano, class of 97, thought he'd end up as a politician. I ask him about his ambitions these days. He said he'd like to open Zero Bond in 8 markets and open Sartiano's in 25. He wants to produce a screenplay that he wrote. Is that it? That's it. Just raise my kids, build New York City, he said. Maybe run for mayor. After our tour of the future Zero Bond space in Las Vegas, Sartiano changed into a suit for dinner at Delilah, a West Hollywood supper club where Drake hosted his 30th birthday that has been replicated at the Wynn. The Vegas edition is twice the size, sporting oodles of marble and 4 gigantic golden brass palm trees. The entire place had been bought out for Super Bowl weekend by DraftKings, the sports betting platform with a market cap of nearly $20 billion. Sartiano introduced me to the restaurant's owners, H-Wood Group founders John Terzin and Brian Toll. Sartiano knew the general manager and the bartenders and the table of high rollers. Down in the cabaret lounge, a manager said that Justin Bieber, whom I'd last seen jumping around shirtless, yelling about Ice Spice, would be performing later. When dinner was over, Sartiano retired to the bar, where the crowd included Barstool Sports founder Dave Portnoy and Glenn Powell. Dinner segued into a party, with a crew setting up the stage for guest performers. At one point, I attempted to take a seat at what I was sure was the worst table in the restaurant, but was told even that was reserved. Corey Gamble and Kris Jenner would arrive and sit there in short order. At a certain point, Sartiano suggested that we check out another venue at the Wynn, XS, the ultra-opulent 40,000-square-foot venue that for years has been among the highest-grossing nightclubs on the planet. Despite the fact that XS was definitely the most peak Vegas place that a NoHo guy could possibly end up at the night before the Super Bowl, Sartiano really wanted to go. He had to chase the juice. When he arrived, there was a scrum of people, clearly uninvited, trying to get in, and Sartiano told the people at the door who he was. Within seconds, there was a handler taking us through various checkpoints around a crowd of thousands. He passed rows of tables, each secured for an average of $30,000 a pop, until arriving at the base of the DJ booth, where a very friendly Alex Paul of the Chainsmokers was offering beer and multiple rounds of tequila shots. Paul and the other chain smoker, Drew Taggart, were actually about to DJ themselves. He pulled Sartiano with him, and the booth was a strange consortium of the 1% and dance music enthusiast. In one corner was once again Josh Kushner, and not far from him was his friend Mikey Hess, who is now joined by his father, John Hess, who runs the namesake Fossil Fuel Company. Not far off was Goldman Sachs CEO David Solomon, who works his own DJ shtick on the weekends. I looked at Sartiano. This had been his perch for decades. On a certain level, he loved it. This was the epitome of fun for the richest people in America. But he also missed his kids, missed his friends, missed the vibe that he had built in a big downtown loft in Manhattan. I ask him if this is what he wanted for Zero Bond at the Wynn. These people, yes, he screamed, motioning to the VIPs in the booth. These people, Sartiano said, but not here. Devil's Eve, 1982. Before she was killed by her ex-boyfriend, Dominique Dunn had been poised for Hollywood stardom. The crime launched her father, Dominic, into his calling, covering high-profile court cases for this magazine. The tragedy also reshaped their family, as Griffin Dunn writes in his memoir, The Friday Afternoon Club. Opening photo, family ties, the Dunn children, Alex, Dominique, and Griffin, at the beach in 1970. At 3 a.m., during the early hours of Halloween 1982, Detective Harold Johnston of the West Hollywood Homicide Division rang the doorbell of my mother's house in the flats of Beverly Hills. Marina, her live-in housekeeper, woke to the sound and let the detective in. When she led Johnston into Mom's bedroom, the lights were on, and she was already sitting up in bed, bracing herself for news that is never good at that time of night. The first thing that caught Johnston's eye was my mother's wheelchair. He was a tough Irish cop who'd made countless house calls like this before, but never to a lady like Mrs. Ellen Griffin Dunn of 528 Crescent Drive North. He took in the wheelchair, the collection of glass hippos lining the shelves of an overstuffed bookcase, a bowl of rosebuds floating in water, and a black cat lying protectively on my mother's lap, both of them waiting for the detective to get to the reason for his visit. The closest murder had ever come to this house was in the pages of the George Simenon novel on the bedside table. Johnston gently informed my mother that her daughter had been strangled by a man named John Sweeney. At this moment, Dominique Dunn was still alive, though she had been placed on life support at Cedars-Sinai Hospital. The detective asked if there was anyone she'd like to call. Though they had been divorced for 16 years, my father was the first and only person who came to mind. She reached for the phone, but it fell to the floor, scaring the cat off her lap. Her hands trembled so much, she fumbled the numbers on the rotary dial. She gave up and handed the phone to the detective and told him Dad's number in New York City. "Thank you," she said when he handed it back. "Nick, I'm here with a homicide detective named... I'm sorry, I forgot your name. Detective Harold Johnston, would you like me to speak to him?" "Yes, please, thank you." After delivering the news to my father, the detective handed her back the phone. "Nick," she said, "I need you. I'll be on the next plane." After they hung up, Dad's next call was to me at my apartment, three blocks from his. "I can't tell if I'm dreaming now or what," he said after relaying his conversation with Johnston. I'd had 2 hours of sleep, and the taste of cocaine still lingered in the back of my throat, so it took a moment to focus. "Wait, did you say homicide detective?" I asked, bolting out of bed. "Griffin, get over here now. I need you." Next photos, homegoing. Alex, Dominique, and Griffin with their father, Dominic Dunn, in 1967 at the Chateau Marmont. Dominique with her mother, Lenny, following the funeral of Natalie Wood in 1981. Joan Didion, John Gregory Dunn, and Griffin on Christmas Day. From the program for Dominique's funeral, featuring Dominique as a baby. There was no scenario in 1982 where either Alex, Dominique, or I would have been spared a violent death. At that time and in different ways, the three of us were placed in situations designed to end our lives, though only two of us would survive. We had wrongly assumed that the demons that haunted my brother Alex had been put to rest when he returned from Silver Hill. He listened to music without demanding credit from the artist, and spoke no more of marrying pop stars. But just because he didn't speak of it didn't mean he wasn't thinking it. He had learned that confiding in anyone about his divine powers could send him to a psych ward, and had also learned how to live with the burden of his lonely secrets. Before Alex moved to Pitt Street, he stayed at a rooming house I found for him only a few buildings from mine. One day, Dad dropped by unannounced to invite him to lunch. Alex answered the door in a harried state, maybe adjusting to the surprise of his father's sudden appearance. "Let me get my coat," he said, and then rooted through a cedar closet to find it. While Alex cursed at the closet for hiding his coat, furiously sliding hangers from side to side, Dad saw a thick rope coiled on a table fit with a hangman's knot. He grabbed it and managed to fit it into his overcoat before Alex turned around. At lunch, Alex asked Dad how his book was going. The questions were intelligent and showed a real understanding of a writer's process. Dad answered each one with a controlled calm, as if addressing someone strapped to a bomb, and hoped the suppressed panic in his voice would go unnoticed. He thought what a brilliant writer, or maybe an editor to other brilliant writers, Alex could have been if mental illness had not set out to waste his talent. Dad couldn't bring himself to mention the rope. "Why?" I asked, when he rushed to my apartment after their lunch to tell me what happened. "I don't know. I was scared he'd be angry that I invaded his privacy and try to kill himself sooner. When I stole the rope, I thought maybe I'd bought some time. Maybe he'd see the rope was missing and take it as a sign. I don't know, Griffin. I'm so scared. I don't think your mother could take it." I didn't bring up the rope to Alex either, because I was also scared. In fact, so many things scared me. I was scared I would lose him. The thoughts he lived with scared me. The waiting for something awful to happen scared me. And I was scared for my mother if he did such a thing. What Alex might or might not do was out of my control, and that scared me the most. The Grim Reaper dropped in on me a month later. It was the first day of rehearsal for a play I'd been cast in called Hooters. Just like the name of the restaurant chain with the buxom waitresses, it was a coming-of-age comedy written by Ted Talley, the same author who wrote Coming Attractions, the play I was starring in when John Lennon was assassinated. Ted went on to write more serious work, even winning an Academy Award for The Silence of the Lambs. I played an awkward teen who idolizes a tough kid who thinks himself a ladies' man and coaches me on the art of getting laid. Frank Rich would rightly point out in his review for the New York Times that I was too old for the role. After reading through the first act, the cast had broken for lunch, and everyone left feeling certain we had a hit on our hands. I asked the guy playing my idol if he'd like to get a bite, and we decided on a place a block away on 10th Avenue in the heart of Hell's Kitchen. A beat-up old Chrysler from the 70s rounded the corner where we stood at the curb, and as it slowly passed, the driver hucked an enormous loogie into my co-star's face. The phlegm hit him square on the nose and splashed in his eyes. I impulsively managed to get a good, strong kick on the car's taillight. The Chrysler slammed on its brakes, and two of the largest guys I'd ever seen rushed toward me. The guy in the lead wore a Born in the USA t-shirt, and when his fist connected with my face, I swear I was thinking, "I love Bruce Springsteen. He loves Bruce Springsteen. What is the problem?" To my amazement, I didn't go down and instead got him into a headlock that brought us both to the pavement. Then I thought, "Oh shit, now what am I going to do?" My hesitation gave him time to break my headlock, grab my hair, and pound my skull into the pavement over and over while punching me in the face between slams. The actor playing the tough kid was nowhere in sight. Finally, the guy's friend pulled him off, saying, "Stop it, you're going to kill him." By now, a crowd had gathered, though no one interceded. Despite the blood running from my nose and mouth and my loose teeth, a rush of adrenaline and rage brought me to my feet, and I chased Springsteen, who was walking calmly back to his car, and screamed, "Come here, you MF!" His friend blocked my path and gripped me by the collar. In a quiet but chilling tone, He leaned his face into mine and said, "You are in real danger here. Stand down." I believed him. Someone in the crowd yelled, "He's got a gun," and we both turned around to see that Springsteen had yanked a pistol from the front seat and pointed it toward me. His friend shielded my body and yelled at him to get back in the car, which he did. They drove off, and the crowd went on with their business. When shock later took hold, I couldn't get over how stupid I'd been to go back to Springsteen for seconds. I felt not bravado, but utter shame for toying with my life and almost causing my mother such grief. In the early morning hours of October 31st, 1982, I was finishing off the remains of a little baggie of Coke in the bathroom of Cafe Central, an actor's hangout on the Upper West Side. Hooters had opened 10 days earlier to tepid reviews, and not a night went by that I didn't drop by after the show to commiserate with colleagues. While I shuffled, coked to the gills, between the bar and the bathroom, in Pacific Standard Time, Dominique was fighting for her life in the front yard of her house at 8723 Rangeley Avenue. She was 22 days shy of her 23rd birthday. A month earlier, to everyone's relief, she had kicked John Sweeney out of her life. Dominique had been confiding in me that their troubles began soon after they moved in together. She was seeing less of her gang from the Friday Afternoon Club, a party Dominique threw every week for the actors in her acting class. Their burgeoning careers made Sweeney feel like a failure for still being a sous chef at Ma Maison, which he took out on her. He would accuse her of flirting with any man she spoke to and tried to possess every moment of her time. "Griffin, sometimes I think he loves me too much," she said, which I heard, but again didn't really take in. What got my full attention was when she told me in a later conversation about his first attempt to strangle her. That attack dispelled the last illusion she had about Sweeney, a point she drove home by leaving his bags on the front lawn and changing the locks to her house. An argument had escalated the night before. What it was about or how it started, I will never know. What is known is that he strangled Dominique to the brink of her blacking out, but somehow she managed to escape through an open window in her house to the safety of her VW Bug. Sweeney was so enraged that he caught up with her in the driveway and climbed on the roof of her car, demanding she get out. Dominique put the Bug in gear and took off, sending him flying to the curb. She drove to Norman Carby's house and banged on his door in hysterics. While trying to calm her, he saw dark purple welts around her throat, and as horrified as he was to see his friend so violently abused, Norman knew the attack should be documented and took pictures of her injuries. "You want to hear something really effed up?" she asked Norman later, climbing into the bed he had given her for the night. "Tomorrow is my first day of shooting an episode of Hill Street Blues." "I think that's great. Work will take your mind off all this." "Except I'm playing a battered housewife whose husband tried to strangle her." "Well," Norman said, "at least you won't have to wear makeup." It was the perfect thing to say, and Dominique belly laughed for the first time since her escape. Feelings of shame and self-blame, familiar to every victim of domestic violence, began their hateful work on my sister's sense of self. Even though she had taken decisive action by breaking up with Sweeney, doubt still plagued her. Dominique called me a month after their breakup, and the second-guessing in her tone annoyed me. She also caught me as I was halfway out the door to catch a new Woody Allen film called A Midsummer Night's Sex Comedy. Dominique didn't exactly say she wanted to get back together with Sweeney, or even that she missed him, but questioned whether she might have been too harsh, and confessed she felt sorry for him. I checked my watch to recalculate what time I'd arrive at the Beekman Theater if I left right then. I'd missed the trailers, but might still make the movie. In the interest of time, I decided not to tell her that days earlier, Sweeney had phoned to see if I might help him reconcile with my sister. He was so delusional that he imagined I would actually act as their couples therapist, and then told me I was the only person who really understood him, because I'd produced Baby, It's You, which he took to be his life story. That movie was not about you, and if you watched it carefully, you would have noticed that the Sheik never strangled Rosanna Arquette. Griffin, I'm so sorry I lost it like that. I never meant. Shut up. Touch my sister again, and I will kill you. If I ever did, I'd give you the gun to kill me, he said, as if his passionate play on words would win me over. Stay the F away from her, I said, and hung up on him. I also did not tell Dominique about that conversation, because she might have found romance and genuine remorse in Sweeney's brave gesture of calling her older brother. I didn't know that the last words I would ever say to my sister would be, Dominique, I'm so sorry, but can I call you tomorrow? I'm running late for a movie. I meant to call the next day, but didn't. Nor did I the day after that, which was October 30th. The date that Sweeney showed up at Rangeley Avenue, holding a bag of Halloween cookies he just baked. 10 minutes later, his hands were around her throat. Dad's call woke me from my late night at Cafe Central the second he got off the phone with Mom. I raced to his apartment in the early morning darkness. While he packed, I made his reservation for the next flight out. The plan was for him to go first, and Alex and I would follow. It felt good to be useful, to speak to a ticket agent who didn't know or care about anyone's reason for departure. Her efficiency made my life seem normal, and I wanted to keep her on the line a little longer so it would stay that way. Dad held up a dark suit and stared at it. I don't know if it's bad luck to bring it. He looked at me for an answer. I don't know either. He rested the suit on top of the Louis Vuitton suitcase, the one Henry Fonda had given him decades earlier, back when he made movies, when he had money, when his daughter helped him pack on his last day in Cortina. I gotta get Alex, I said. We hugged, neither of us wanting to make a big deal about it, not wanting to give strength to our growing dread. The most Dad could muster was only, oh, kiddo, what the F. I raced to Pitt Street, cursing my luck to have a brother who refused to own a phone. I climbed his piss-stained stairway and banged on his door for some time before he opened it. He looked startled, then fearful to see me. What? He said, not wanting to know what the what was. Alex, something happened to Dominique. It's Sweeney, isn't it? We sat in the back of a TWA flight that wouldn't arrive in Los Angeles until early evening. We declined the meal from the stewardess, ordering Cokes instead. Oh, I said before she left, could you bring us some nuts? After a brief silence, Alex mumbled something I couldn't make out. What? I asked. I said, bring some shit for my fly. Why does that sound familiar? It's the B. Kleban cartoon that Dominique loved. A guy in a fancy restaurant sits across from a huge fly and orders gazpacho, leeks, vinaigrette, a bottle of Cote d'Aron 59, and then tells the waiter, and bring some shit for my fly. The joke didn't make us laugh, but the image of our sister's wicked grin was conjured in the private universe of our separate memories. In mine, I remembered her teasing me for having a crush on one of her friends. She wouldn't give you the time of day, she said about a girl who was dating the drummer in Huey Lewis's band. I held on to her mischievous smile in my mind's eye for as long as I could, but it floated off. Next photos, three of a kind. Alex, Dominique, and Griffin on Crescent Drive with Brinsley the rat catcher. Griffin in New York in the mid-80s. There were photographers and news cameras in front of Cedars-Sinai, so someone from the hospital's public relations found another entrance for us. We announced ourselves to an ICU nurse, who explained she couldn't let us in until she saw our identification, because some members of the press had tried to pass themselves off as family to get a picture of Dominique on life support. Johnston was waiting for us, and after gently greeting my mother, introduced himself to Alex's dad and me. He seemed genuinely upset, even angered by our circumstance, and we liked him immediately. "You should prepare yourselves," the nurse said, and unlocked the door to the ICU for us to follow her to Dominique's room. The three of us slowly entered, far from prepared to see a swollen creature connected to a machine that wheezed an accordion-shaped bag up and down in sync with labored breathing. Dominique's head was shaved, and there were bolts boring into her skull. Her skin was the color of a bruised peach, and her eyeballs bulged like a cartoon character who put her finger in a light socket. An air tube, crudely taped into her mouth, was connected to the machine that made the hideous wheezing sound. We stood just inside the room, none of us sure what to do until Mom took control and wheeled over to her bedside. She took her daughter's hand and said, "Darling, it's Mom. I'm here with Dad and your brothers, and we love you." We joined Mom around the bed, each of us touching a part of Dominique's body, a hand, a leg, stroking her cold skin, each of us overlapping. "We love you, Dominique. We love you so much. We're right here." We went to the hospital every day. Dominique was unresponsive. But once, when a doctor came to check on her, I felt her grip my hand for just a second. "I just felt her move," I exclaimed in excitement. The doctor said it was only an electroimpulse. Her brain still showed no activity. "If she comes out of it, will there be brain damage?" my father asked. "Should your daughter recover, I'm afraid the damage would be massive and irreparable." The subtext was that Dominique would never recover, and at some point she would have to be taken off life support, but no one was ready for that conversation. A worse alternative than death would be for her to live out her life in a vegetative state, and the very thought was so painful I suppressed it as much as possible. "Please come back," Dad would say, leaning close to her ear. Sometimes I had my doubts Dominique would come back, but Alex's faith restored me. At the end of the day, when it came time for us to leave, Alex refused and stayed all night reading her the poems of Yeats and W.S. Merwin's Snowfall over and over like chants, as if the recitation of high art might somehow awaken her. Alex also stayed to avoid the steady stream of well-wishers bearing catered meals, booze, and comfort who continued to arrive at the house on Crescent Drive. Dad was staying with John and Joan, who had both been at our house every day, and on one of those days I caught Dad focusing his glare on them across the room. Shortly after Sweeney's arrest, we were shocked to learn from the local news that Ma Maison had hired an attorney to defend their sous chef. John and Joan were friends of the owner, Patrick Terrail, who knew Dominique as well, and Dad had already been stewing over the fact that Terrail never bothered to reach out to her parents with a word of sympathy. On a morning when John and Joan were absent, Dad signed for a large orchid that had been delivered to them. To not peek at the card to find out who sent the orchid was simply too much to ask of my father. Dad opened the sealed envelope gently to leave no trace of his trespass. The card read, "My heart breaks for you, Patrick Terrail." He immediately called me in a rage. That effer lawyered up to protect the killer and then sends John and Joan flowers. I bet they're having lunch at Ma Maison right now. "I doubt that very much," I said, but Dad wasn't buying it. He couldn't very well admit to reading Terrail's note, but moved out anyway without explanation before John and Joan returned. John called me soon after his brother's abrupt exit to ask what happened, and I told him about the orchid and that Dad knew who sent it. I can't control who sends us flowers, Griffin. I know, but I gotta ask. Dad also thinks you still go to ma maison. Is that true?
Are you crazy?
Well, yes, I think we all are. We would never set foot in that place, and never will. I chose to believe him, but the unfounded accusation, the orchid, and the note from Terrail sent my brother and Dominique's best friend, Melinda, around the bend. They vowed not to let this treason go unanswered. On day 4 of Dominique being on life support, Rupert Allen asked if he could speak to me alone, and I followed him outside. Rupert was a publicist and old family friend, whose clients had been Marilyn Monroe, Marlene Dietrich, and Princess Grace of Monaco. He volunteered to field and deny the countless requests from the press to interview the Dunns. His first order of business was to correct a misconception that was carried in all the papers that only added to my father's anger. They all described Dominique as the niece of John Dunn and Joan Didion. He complained to Mom and her mother, who had just flown in from San Diego. Mom had stayed close with John and Joan since her divorce from Dad, and hadn't the patience for his sibling rivalry. She didn't know about the orchid from Terrail. What difference does it make? Mom sighed, irritated to be reminded of superficial concerns that had troubled her ex-husband when they were married. Nick's right, said Gammer, my mother's mother. It makes it sound like she doesn't have parents. Dad knew his mother-in-law could barely tolerate him and was surprised by her sudden support. All right, Mom said after mulling it over, have Rupert take care of it. Rupert led me out of earshot from the house and took a long beat before deciding to speak. I don't want to bother your parents with this, but when Dominique dies, a statement must be released to the press from the family. I put something together that is brief and dignified that I wanted you to read before I show it to Nick and Lenny. I thought maybe I didn't hear him correctly, or maybe misunderstood what he'd said. Or maybe he was the one who was confused. But Dominique is not dead. She's still alive. No, of course, Rupert admitted, immediately regretting this conversation. But he plugged on, I mean, when she dies, a statement must be in place. It's how things are done. You mean, if she dies. An unexpected assault of tears ambushed me in the driveway. No one until then had ever said that Dominique would die, and I felt like a fool that it was so obvious to everyone but me. Oh, son, I'm so sorry to have brought this up. It was a terrible mistake. Please forgive me. His remorse was genuine, and I knew in that moment that he was just looking out for us, and that, of course, my sister would die. I went back inside the house, taking in all the people who'd been hugging me for days, telling me to keep strong, that Dominique was a fighter. Everyone looked different than they had only minutes earlier. What I hadn't seen, but which was suddenly clear, was that Alex and I were the last to know that the past 4 days had been one long wake. Something shifted within me, and I suddenly felt different as well. My perspective and personality took on a new formation not yet defined. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.